Miss Esther Muller was there to meet us, and Mr. Walter Tatch. I pointed out to Stuart the citation the Department of the Interior had given Tatch Home in 1934. With Icky's signature, it was still hanging proudly on the wall. But one of the German pressmen found something that delighted him even more, an engraving of the city in Germany from which he had come. Everybody was eager to tell us everything. There was lots of German spoken. And all along the street, ladies in the costumes of the 1840s and 1850s. One or two, quite elegant, and you felt sure they had gotten them out of the trunks at home. And then we stopped at the old Kamala House, now the Pioneer Museum. And there were my two friends, the very elderly ladies who had known Lyndon as a boy. I signed the register. They must have a dozen or more of my signatures now, and so did many of the press. And then, because this part of the building was the Kamala's old general store, I pointed out to them some of the articles that the pioneers had bought and sold. Cornmeal, ground at a local grist mill. A deer head, the trademark on the sack. And they still had the old press or dye, which had imprinted on the cloth the head of the deer. Sulfur matches, sold in bulk from a big tin container. An ancient bottle of liniment. And other remedies for the ills of man and beast. Everybody looked at what interested him most, a handsome deerskin jacket, elaborately beaded and fringed, that had been worn to Baron von Moisebach's peace parley, Indian Chief Santana, by some pioneer. A tiny-waisted, white satin wedding dress. And an engraving made in some town of Bavaria of the weeping local citizens saying goodbye to the adventurous pioneers who were setting off for faraway Texas. I took my vanity out to powder my nose. It crashed to the floor. I picked it up, and they rushed for me. I hope it didn't break. I opened it, and the glass was in 100 tiny fragments. I hope no one had heard me, but it was part of the undercurrent of the day. Underneath the sunshine and bright excitement and genuine interest, there was a sense of expectancy of we knew not what, almost a foreboding. We went into the kitchen, and here it was more evident than anywhere that the ladies had worked hard for our coming. Usually, the kitchen is so full of artifacts, there are waffle irons piled on top of coffee grinders, piled on top of cookie cutters. Now, it was just as though the kitchen were in operation. There was wood in the fireplace. There was a big old straw basket loaded with vegetables that might have just been brought in from the garden. Squash and cabbage and a string of onions hanging. We went out into the little paved patio, and everywhere the foreign editors were busy clickety-click taking pictures of a pretty girl against the well, one of the hostesses, of other hostesses in their dresses of the 1840s and 50s, while the hostesses explained that the house had grown with the generations of Kamalas, and actually there were three kitchens. We went on out into the backyard, and there was a tent. They really had gone to a lot of trouble with us, and German pastries, and anxious hostesses, and hot steaming coffee. It had been a long time since that brunch on the plane, and I was ravenous, as I always am on these trips. But there were hands to shake, and thanks to bestow, and waves to familiar faces across the crowd, and I knew I was about to cut off to go home by car for a 15-minute advance before the press arrived in the bus. Alas, something else had been laid on, a bit of the pageant from the Easter fires. Mr. Petmecky took the floor, or rather the stump, and told about the Easter fires, and children in pink and blue Easter bunny costumes came out hippity-hop, while I wiggled as much as they did in my anxiety to get gone. Signal one of the staff who came over and spoke to me, and then I waved my thanks and goodbye, and I hoped slipped away. Later, I read where some press person described it as received news of the rioting in Washington and left quickly with tears in my eyes. That has become a stock expression of me, and never until yet my reaction, at least in regard to Lyndon's decision. Once in the car, I asked Jerry my first chance. How's everything in Washington? His voice came back heavily for him. Not good. Fires and rioting. Trouble on 14th Street. Supposed to be three persons killed. We hurried home, and I changed into my blue denim skirt and red plaid blouse and was out by the side gate after having had a brief fill-in from Carol and Wheezy, and the first of the press buses rolled up. For the next 3 hours, I was their number one tour guide around the LBJ Ranch, and this may have been the most memorable part of the trip for them. For the wrong reason, later I heard that they kept on exclaiming, "How surprising! She did it herself! Can you ever imagine Queen Elizabeth doing it?" Mrs. de Gaulle, it appeared that the London editor had even bet one of the young ladies that he'd sent that she would never meet me. I invited them in, and with the help of Wheezy and Jewel, attempted to tell the ladies where they could powder their noses and the gentlemen where they could wash their hands in the language for such occasions. And then tried to conduct a tour of the living room, den, and dining room. Such affairs are always disorganized and haphazard, short of having a whip-cracking drill sergeant. Even so, it was relatively good. I don't think I ever had a more interested audience. In the den, I stood on the steps and told them about the piece of needlework that was made by the daughter of not one Texas governor, but two, the old legend of Maw and Paul Ferguson. Many of them, surprisingly and with keen interest, knew about it. Our beautiful old oak table from Sherwood Forest, copper pieces picked up at the flea market in Paris, and something of the history of the house. Had it been a familiar home to Lyndon since he was 4 years old, when he used to come to visit his aunt and uncle, who had actually lived here for 46 years. It was a scene of family reunions and Christmas dinners and big Thanksgiving parties. In the living room, I stood on the raised fireplace and told them something of the visiting chiefs of state, pointing out the letter from Sam Houston, the facsimile. Beautiful old colonial chest from Dear Sir Das, and the charming country piece, The Corner Cupboard, from the President of Finland. But mostly our personal feeling about the house and the country, what it meant to us, how it had grown and we'd added to it in the 16 years that we'd had it, and I told them all to look at the thickness of the walls built by the first old German, Mr. Meyer, who had built it of native stone in 1892, as one great big room with probably stair steps up the outside and a sort of a low loft room upstairs. I'm sure that not more than half of them heard half of what I had to say, but nevertheless, I felt it was a plus. And then we got on the buses, I in the first and Betty Weinheimer in the second, and took them down to the house where Lyndon was born, showing them Lyndon's grandfather's house along the way. Then the family cemetery. I explained that this was a family custom in the South, rural sections. At the birthplace house, I stood on the front porch and gave them a brief picture of Mr. and Mrs. Johnson's marriage and moving here and Lyndon's birth and what the country was like then. And then I took up my place as guide in the West Room and Betty Weinheimer in the East Room. And they all wandered through. And I kept up my stream of description and they asked questions. Surprisingly, Anne Chamberlain, representing the Saturday Evening Post, whom I would have thought of as one of the rather more snide and unimpressionable ones. I remember her from our tour with the Kennedy girls in the fall of 1960, and I thought she was probably expecting me to pull out my snuff bottle any minute. But she seemed one of the most interested and eager and actually simpatico of the lot. It remains to be seen what she will write. Here, we changed to the school buses from Johnson City, and there were three. I was the guide in the first one, and then Dale Malachek and Tom Weinheimer, whom I attempted, perhaps not with complete success, to introduce to the crowd. You really need a bullhorn and a commanding presence, and neither one suits me. On the way back, I pointed out the grove where we had barbecues for everybody from visiting chiefs of state like Lopez Mateus and Adenauer and Ayub Khan, 4-H youngsters, and last year just this time, some 26 of the ambassadors from Latin American countries. And then we toured the ranch. I'd had to make the decision whether to try to show them the wildlife, mostly, or the farm operation, mostly. I had chosen the first. I now wish I had done the last. At any rate, we went through the dance and later the Martin, and there was a blessing of wildflowers
though not the meal floor carpet that awaited us by Easter. And when we came to a strutting wild turkey gobbler, we nearly lost one of the photographers who got out and followed him down the fence, taking pictures while the buses went on. We had to stop and call him back. Saw plenty of deer, and they were interested, but not as ecstatic as I would have liked. Actually, such a trip is a great, big, unending lesson to me. And I was glad of every expression of enthusiasm that I had not been able to suppress at Mar-a-Lago and all the places I've been. Because when one loves a place and has worked on it, it's inordinately pleasant to hear somebody else receive it with enthusiasm. The trip was long, and I think, to borrow a story from Lyndon, I gave them a little bit more about Finland than they wanted to know. It was 6 o'clock and getting remarkably chilly when we got back to the house. A red checkered tablecloth spread, a great long table laden with ribs and chicken legs and chili con queso with fritos. Beer and soft drinks were being passed, and hot coffee, the most welcome of all. And we were ravenous. These were actually only hors d'oeuvres, but hearty ones because they hadn't really had a meal. Since 9:30 Washington time, and here it was past 6. So everybody fell to. I divided myself between gulping food and trying to answer questions enthusiastically. Saw with approval the sign my staff had hung across the front porch. Welcome travelers. Noted that practically everybody had put on the red bandana which little Carol had stood and dispensed at the gate as they came in, and decided that the tamales were the hit of the day. Shivering, I got some more coffee just as Cactus rose to introduce Brownie McNeil as one college president could sing protest songs right back to his students. And Brownie, because it was nearly 7, gave them a shortened version of how the folk songs of the Southwest are the expression of the pioneers as they came from Tennessee and Kentucky and Alabama, and of the Spanish and Mexican strains, and the confluence of civilizations here in this part of the world. I'm always so proud of this act and how much we have called on them for. At 7 o'clock, they were saying goodbye, and I stood at the gate and shook hands as they piled into the buses and left for San Antonio. And then there was nobody left in the yard but me and Brownie and his son and the Weinheimers and Malacheks and Deese and Carol Carlisle and Cynthia Wilson, who had advanced this part of the trip, and Marilyn. So we went in the living room. I invited them to have another drink and eat the leftovers with me, and Mary heated up some beans and got out some homemade bread and spread out what was left of the ribs and chicken legs and plenty of preserves on the sideboard. But first, we put up our feet and had an interesting talk about our impressions of journalists and theirs, probably, of us, about the dreadful news from Washington and spreading throughout the country and other cities, and the responsibility of the news media in reporting on these national crises. I asked Brownie, and he said on his small campus, now just pushing 2,000, there's no touch of the virus. You have to still work for a living out there. It's rugged country. He got out his guitar and sang some more songs just for us, and I was enchanted. And then we had potluck supper, and I said goodbye and excused myself because I had many phone calls to make and speeches to rewrite. A mesh into the changed world as we found it today. I talked to Washington. Linda, she said the White House was like a fortress. Nobody gets out and nobody gets in. There was rioting and looting and fires on 14th Street and way out down toward the Capitol. Fire hoses were being cut. There was a report that 7 people had been killed and 300 people in District of Columbia Hospital. I remember I asked her some questions, and she said to me rather wearily, Mother, I don't know. It would take the dropping of the hydrogen bomb to get my attention. Of course, I wondered how this should all affect tomorrow, should I even go to Hemisphere. I called Liz, and we hammered and changed and worked on my speeches until I was relatively satisfied with them. I talked to John, and then I had a conference call with John and Liz. John felt that there would be some disturbances at Hemisphere. Probably 3 demonstrations, 1 peace-loving and 2 militant. Mexican-American group and about 1,500 SDS, but he and Nellie were emphatically going right on, and he hoped that I would come. He very much hoped so. Sometime I had talked to my agent. They had suggested two changes. One, that I'd be a little late. Instead of arriving there something around 9:30, that I get there around 10 or 10:30. Second, that I go from building to building in one of the little minibuses rather than walk. Naturally, I agreed. Sometime I talked to Lyndon. The whole sequence of events is rather hazy. He sounded very tired and a little remote. It must have been a shattering, beating day. He said he thought I should go on. There was no flicker of uncertainty in his voice. And so it was about 1 o'clock. Betty Chappewiki had come in and given me a little rub. And I finally got to bed after a day that had ran the full gamut of emotions against a background of mounting turbulence, with our whole nation straining at its seams, and yet with a queer sense of ambivalence. Because, though I was right in the middle of it because of my husband's job and the presence in Washington of all my family, I myself was nevertheless removed and encapsulated in a different world where we were just hearing about them, reading about them, as though they lived on the moon.